connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the computer today.
Computer.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Hello and welcome to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I'm your co-host, Galen. Usually I have Matthew here with me, but unfortunately, Matthew had to go do something. Matthew was a little busy, but that's a shame because right now I have in the studio, please welcome back hit mashup artist Photon Punch.
Hello, welcome.
Hi, hey.
Welcome? I mean, thank you.
Well, welcome and thank you.
You're welcome for me appearing on here. I'm obviously very busy.
I'm honored, yeah. Photon Punch, last time we had you here, it was for your first album debut. Absolute smash hit of Hard Punch, Light Kick.
Mm-hmm.
And we have you here again because we got another album to talk about briefly.
Yes, I just released Casual Lobby, and by just released I mean roughly a month ago.
Yes,
it is of course more of a concept album than the first one.
I have it written on my notes here that it's kind of inspired by the story of a time you went to a hotel.
Yes.
Yeah. I assume some things have happened. I haven't listened to it, of course. I've got more important things to do over the month.
Of course, yes.
I do have in my notes here, so, I just want to, you know, brief interview, of course. We can only have you for a couple minutes. I do have on my notes here that, apparently, you know, reviews are in, and, they're kind of saying that, I think the fans really preferred your older stuff. It kind of seems like you've been biting your style a little bit. You know, it's just, you know, your first one was your original album, Magnum Opus, honestly. It says here, obviously I'm reading out notes, it was a lot of excellent mashups and, it kind of seems like, you're biting your old style and, the fans just want to know, where's the old Photon Punch? Where's the good Photon Punch?
Every great musical artist has a later album that the fans absolutely loathe, you know, but changing up your style is only a part of growing as an artist. I mean, think about everything, like the Beatles, you know, people had some thoughts on the White Album.
Yeah, that is true.
Fall Out Boy changed their style pretty heavily, but now they're more popular than ever. You've got Coheed and Cambria. Obviously, hardly anybody listened to them, but then Color Before the Sun came out and everybody listened to that one. It was on the radio all over the place. And, you know, I've already gotten offers to go on radio shows.
Yeah, I have heard of that, and that's kind of awesome. So if I can just summarize your words, what you're saying is, screw the fans, I hate the fans, and anyone who tells me the fans are disappointed deserves to go die?
Maybe not the last part, but I don't want any entitledness, you know?
All right, yeah, of course.
The only one who's entitled to my albums is me, because I'm the one titling them.
That is true. That is true. You are the title giver.
Mm-hmm. That's actually my true job. The reason I have to leave here is I have to give out a few titles.
Yeah, you're the Terminator. You create terms for things.
Mm-hmm. The Terminator and the title giver.
Yep, yep.
I'm also the creator of the numbers 1984.
Oh, wow.
I'm also the Lord of the Flies, which is to say there's a lot of flies in my room.
Man, wow, we're just learning a lot about you.
I'm also the new Brave Worlder.
It's a shame I can't have you on. You lead a really interesting life.
I'm also where am I going with this? Also the Starship Trooper. Oh no, wait, no. Wait, I don't want to do that. Hold on, let me walk that back.
It says here that you are actually in your spare time the giver.
The giver, actually. Yeah.
Not the giver, you are the giver.
Yeah. I give people.
Yeah. No, you the give people.
I the give people, yes. I have the gift. The give gift. This season. Give the gift of the give gift.
Well, I think we unfortunately have to wrap this interview up, but, if you're looking for, just an absolutely, really rehash album, just a lot more mashups, I would personally say they're good, of course, if I had listened to them. But, you know, if you're looking for a big disappointment to the fans, the longtime Photon Punch fans, please listen to Casual Lobby to break kayfabe. It is actually very good.
Who's kayfabe?
Someone I broke.
Oh, no. I'm also the broker.
Oh, no.
Now I'm off to do my next job, the bouncer.
Damn it, I was about to ask.
The bouncer. All right, I gotta bounce.
All right, well, hang on. Wow, actually, it turns out that Photon Punch wasn't lying. They just bounced right out the window, huh? Good thing we got that silent glass. Matthew should be appearing sometime soon.
Yo, who the fuck broke my window?
Oh, hey, Matthew.
Somebody broke my window?
Yeah, apparently somebody broke your window. I don't know who. It was Photon Punch. You might have heard of him.
It was Photon Punch?
Yeah, the Photon Punch.
Photon Punch gave me the job of host of Netsurfer Pro. Did you know that?
Oh my god. I only thought he was the bouncer.
They gave me the title.
Wow. They... Wait a minute, was I given the title of co-host from Photon Punch 2?
You may have the Ben.
Oh my goodness. So long as he hasn't the Ben drowned.
He's actually the Ben Fold.
Oh good.
He goes up to poker tables, puts in a chip, and it says, I fold, and leaves.
Wow.
Famous pot fiend. Casinos love him.
Casinos love him, but doctors hate him.
Yeah.
Because of this one weird trick.
This one weird trick to punch the literal photons.
So.
I never learned if it's you punch photons or you punch with the power of photons.
I think
And frankly, the world may never know.
I think it's you turn into photons when you punch.
We may just be speculating.
We are perhaps speculating. And you know what they say about speculation? It makes a spec out of you and a guy named Lation.
Professor?
Professor Lation. So as you've almost certainly guessed, this is a show about internet things.
Yes.
So
we have a huge, a big, fun episode I've been wanting to talk about for years, but we are going to instead talk about a few memes first that we have waited months to talk about.
Yes, we've been a little bit behind on meme culture, so it's time for a bit of a state of the meme. All right, so we only have a couple of brief ones because I am also very much excited to talk about the main topic today. But first up on the chopping block, we have the dancing cat, the breakdancing cat meme.
Yes.
Very fun meme, probably my favorite of recent memory. Unfortunately, I would say it's dead right now. But it definitely is dying because it has a pretty bad half-life.
Right. So this is a meme where it is from like a PS2 game.
It's from The Sims.
The Sims?
Really? The original video is from The Sims. It's like some mod.
Oh, okay.
Of like a cat that does a breakdancing move and then does another breakdancing move.
Yeah, and they put some like really chill drum and bass to it.
Yeah, I know that I have the actual name written down somewhere because it's it's specifically from a Pache Studio Set album.
Mm-hmm. But, so people started remaking it with, like, different things as the cat and the person. Usually the cat is not only an animal, but just, like, a little guy.
Yeah, yeah. There's, somebody made it with, like, a Hollow Knight, and it's the Hollow Knight.
Yeah, somebody made it with, the player character from Disco Elysium to avoid spoilers, dancing in front of Kim Kitsuraki. Today I saw May from Guilty Gear in front of Chips Enough.
I've also seen, the cat from Nichijou in front of the robot girl from Nichijou.
Yeah.
And then the scientist character from Nichijou joins the cat.
That's good. That's
which is very good.
Yeah. The thing that makes it a low shelf life or a low half-life or both is that it requires high quality edits to work.
Yes.
Which means that for one thing, like, you know, you need really skilled artists to do it, but not a lot of artists are going to do more than one. So there's kind of just a low supply of new content that way. But also, The other thing is that just it relies a lot on the characters that you put in there.
Yes.
And it is hard to find more characters that have not been already done.
Yes, yes. It requires, you know, like, a character that kind of works as, like, a little goblin or just a little guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, another character who has to work as sort of the quote-unquote straight man in the scenario.
Yeah.
The most interesting thing I want to bring up about it is that it feels almost like a bit of a breakthrough from an animation meme into a internet meme.
Mm-hmm.
So animation memes are different from internet memes, despite having the same exact name. Animation memes are usually kind of like just a little thing to direct an animation towards. Sometimes it's a character dancing. Sometimes it's a character doing a different kind of dance.
Sometimes it's like a song.
Yeah, sometimes it's like a character running to a certain song. It's just, you know, it is a meme in sort of the, like, literal sense, the, like, literal genetics of the soul sense of, like, something that animators like to put their characters to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different from an internet meme in that an internet meme is, you know,
it is pretty similar to an internet meme. I think generally the use case of it is different. It's more about, like, a way to practice animation and or a way to animate just, like, your favorite characters or your OCs or something.
Yeah.
It's usually often more about the style the animator brings to it rather than the content of the animation or the joke being presented.
Yeah.
Because there's not always a joke.
Yeah, whereas I think that the internet meme is a little bit more about the joke. Like, the animation of, for example, like, the Disco Elysium one is good, but the reason that you like it and retweet it isn't, this is good animation, it's, haha, it's the player character doing a little breakdance.
Yeah. This one is sort of both in that way,
yeah.
For sure. Yeah, it's definitely interesting when you consider it in that sense.
Yep.
I'm used to a lot of animation memes being, like, a short, like, 30-second song that somebody animates over.
Yeah.
And those are like, oh, it's like a mini music video, and everyone has their own style.
Animation memes are fun. If you don't follow one or two, you know, creators with a fun OC that do animation memes, you should. It's a fun time. Moving right along, I want to talk about Jordan Peterson in the briefest possible terms.
Yes.
Okay, so, Up Yours, Woke Moralists, We'll See Who Cancels Who is objectively hilarious.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm going to get out everything I want to say in 30 seconds or less. Alright, so, in general, I am always a little bit hasty about wings about right-wing figureheads, right-wing shitheads, as I'm going to call them,
mm-hmm.
Because it feels like every once in a while you can get one of those that just is them spreading their message. A lot of Alex Jones memes I very much do not like, because it's just kind of like presenting him saying his bullshit and going, haha, look how crazy he is, but if you agree with him, well, you're just kind of spreading his message. Specifically, the reason that I like Up Yours, Woke Moralists, and the reason that I also liked Wet-Ass P-Word.
Wet-Ass P-Word?
From Ben Shapiro, is because it's really obvious that the joke is on them. They are the reason that this is funny, because they are, like, it is stupid, it is hilarious, it is like, how can anybody look at this and go, yes, this is the man who's saving Western civilization. This is the smartest man alive, according to Ben Shapiro.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good because it is themselves doing something that seems like a parody, but because it seems so, like, much like a parody, it's, you can't agree with them.
Yeah.
Though I'm sure plenty of people look at the Up Yours book more or less and think he's like, oh, standing up. But, like,
yeah.
The important thing is that people who aren't already into Jordan Peterson, they're not in the Jordan Peterson fan club, are not going to take Jordan Peterson seriously because of that video.
Exactly, exactly. I have seen, I don't want to get too deep into it. There is a long history of, like, the alt-right using the sort of, like, haha, just joking, no one would ever take this seriously deflection to just spread their message. And so, like, when you have examples like this where, like, it is kind of them just spreading their message, but, like, no one could take this seriously unless they're already buying into this garbage, it's great as meme material, specifically because it's, like, no one is going to be scrolling through TikTok, see this clip, and be like, he sounds like a stable and smart fellow.
Right. I also love people putting it in place of, like, cartoony villains.
Yes.
Like, I saw one with Cortex's head and Crash replaced by Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
I saw one of a Command and Conquer, like, call from the enemy general.
I saw one that was, the replacement was, Dracula from the famous, Symphony of the Night, speech.
What is a man? A miserable pile of 13 rules. throws glass full of apple cider.
Yeah, yeah, the
fucking
only-
fucking cider.
Jordan Peterson, if you're listening to this, and I know you're not, if you want to reach out to us, I would be happy to do a version of Hot Ones, except it's various apple ciders that we just drink. That's the only reason I would want you on the show. I don't want you to talk about your bullshit, but, yeah. Like, if you want to reach out to us.
Yeah. Man. Okay, my state of the meme is Kid Named Finger,
yes.
Which is this perfect mix of, like, Dadaist post memes and also, like, talking about a popular thing. So, there's been a huge uptick in the past few years of playground jokes coming back as memes.
Yes.
Like, this was sort of the whole thing of the Ligma, the Ligmatization, was that, like, Ligma itself is, like, sort of a playground thing of, like, you know, it's like up dog.
Yeah.
Something a kid would go to another kid on the playground and say it. Second kid would think it's the funniest thing ever and then also say it on the playground to the very next kid they saw.
Yeah.
A lot of those are coming back, A, because the internet is trending younger in a lot of those meme spaces. Like, younger kids are having access to meme-making material, and so they are putting the kind of humor they find funny into memes. The other thing is just that, like, a lot of the people who are also making memes that are older are at the age where they're, like, they had those when they were in elementary school. They remember UpDog. Now, Kid Named Finger is itself also a play off one of these.
Yeah, so the origin image, at least my initial interaction with this, was, like, memes that were like, okay, we're going to finger paint today, says the teacher, and then it's like kids named paint.
Yeah.
And that's like, you know, haha.
It's like the picture of, like, Vince McMahon or whatever going, like, pogging.
Yeah, yeah. it's you know the joke.
Yeah.
No, fingerprints. But then, you know, obviously the internet being the internet, we have to turn it on its head.
Yeah, because you can't just have a straightforward joke. If you are in a meme, the every joke has an opposite,
yeah.
An antecedent. And in this case, it's Kid Named Finger. Now, what really makes this funny is in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, there is a guy named Finger who is just like this old guy. He's just like this old guy. All I know, I haven't seen either show. All I know about him is he goes, Walter. Walter.
I haven't seen either. And yeah, this sounds about right.
And so people would start posting Kid Named Finger. And it would either be a picture of Finger or it would be Bob Odenkirk from the intro of Better Call Saul doing that, like, smug, determined face he has.
Yeah.
And I just find the entire, like, coalescence of that really funny.
Yeah.
In a way that is so hard to explain why it's funny to somebody who doesn't know memes.
It's a really good, like, level of abstraction. Like, it's not loss level, but, like, it's a great example to, like, explain how we get from loss to loss, you know?
I also gotta say, really quick, I didn't plan for this at first, but I just remembered it when we were talking. Xbox Live,
yes.
That's on the rise. Invest in Xbox Live.
Invest in Xbox Live.
It's a video of somebody made that's like a YouTube poop or something of Yo Mama, the YouTube channel. But, like, they would switch the setup in the second part of the setup. So the Yo Mama, the setup. And then the punchline would always be Xbox Live.
Yeah.
So it'd be like, Yo Mom is so stupid. If she was an Oreo, she would be Xbox Live.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Somebody made an edit of that where the audio was super compressed and distorted. And then it was put through, like, a sine wave filter. So it sounded like an air raid siren. It was like, Your mama's so big. She was investing in Xbox Live.
It's
and That is extremely, like, Dadaist, like, deep-fried anti-meme.
God, yes.
And that it's almost the point of it is to be indecipherable, but also part of the fun is how much of a breakdown of Yo Mama jokes it is. It's similar to Kid Named Finger in that it is sort of a breakdown of a playground joke or a playground meme. But in this case, it's of Yo Mama jokes and just completely throwing any sense of punchline and setup and execution out the window.
Yeah, deep fried memes are their own issue. Like, they're their own topic. They're almost certainly their own episode where, like, the joke is that the idea that there should be a punchline is the joke.
Yeah.
And so, like,
deep fried memes are a reaction to pop culture in, like, mainstream marketing picking up memes. It's like, oh, you trying to make a Wendy's commercial with memes in it? How about this? And it's Marquard with E.
Yeah. You can't make marketable deep fried memes. And I guess just invest in Xbox Live is the real moral.
I saw a YCPMV sampling it, so you know.
Yeah, it's on the rise.
It's on the rise. That's that's your meme market watch.
YTPMVs are perhaps in their most popular form right now.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay. We've been talking for 20 minutes.
Yes. This is too much. Okay, so we are talking today about Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Okay, so when you are in a gift shop,
you leave.
All right, that's the episode. You can find us on...
Okay, no, so street art.
This
huge
is,
culture.
This is the intersection of a lot of stuff from our generation, I think. A lot of, like, skate culture, a lot of, punk culture.
Might I say this is, like, pre-memes? Kind of related to memes, though.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so the sort of punk culture of the 90s was anti-urbanization in a very complex way. That they don't want gentrification, they don't want corporatism. It is making our own spaces, and also turning public spaces into our own spaces. It's a denial of things like property ownership, of like how cities are quote-unquote public, but they're really just a bunch of privately owned buildings and walkways.
And boy, do I have opinions on that there's, I'll be bringing up.
There's very few actual public spaces.
Yeah.
And so when you get to things like parkour or skateboarding, those are about turning those things that are hostile into playgrounds and parks and, like, physical, like, ways you can get enjoyment out of them.
Yeah.
Street art is about turning the bland facades of buildings and billboards into art, or at least personalizing them. I want to make a point that tagging is street art, but they're kind of different in their philosophy. Tagging is like putting up a signifier or an icon or a name of yourself and putting it on a building. There's sort of a trophy aspect to it of like tagging hard to get spaces.
Yeah.
Or just like, you know, how do you tag under a big overpass, you know? There's the physicality of it, and also the fact that it takes time to do so, and you're kind of trespassing. And this is a form of street art in that it is it's personalizing a very drab sort of facade. You know, you don't do this to murals so much as you do it to things like just brick buildings and highway overpasses. You know, the sides of tunnels going through a hill. Things that have been turned into privatized areas and, like, city sprawl.
Yeah.
And, of course, billboards, which are, you know, advertisements. They are kind of invasive in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think the reason that you end up seeing a lot of this graffiti, a lot of that specific type of graffiti of tagging on famously trains is just that, like, it's a little bit of a status symbol that you are able to pull it off, and it's going to be going everywhere.
Yeah.
So, like, anyone could randomly see, like, oh, hey, Splat tagged that train.
It's sort of a vigilantism. In that, like, you become known as sort of a street artist or a tagger, a graffiti artist. Oftentimes people who do tags will go on to do more, like, mural-type artwork.
Yeah.
Or a lot of stencil-based stuff, but we'll get into the actual medium a bit later.
Yeah.
But, so there is definitely a sort of marketing aspect to it, that you are putting your name and brand out there. But part of why it's tags is because they don't want people suing you for trespassing and arresting you.
Yeah, you can't really, like, market yourself exactly as, like, I'm the guy who did this illegal thing.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to, that we're then going to talk about kind of examples that break that rule.
Yeah.
But the idea is that, like, it's something of building a brand, quote unquote, but what I think separates it from, like, you know, just marketing is the fact that, you know, it is illegal. It is a crime, and it is something that you will get in trouble for. And so, like, there's a bit of prestige to it, but it's prestige in, like, the street sense, not in the sense of, like, you know, I'm Shepard Fairey and now I own fucking Microsoft.
Yeah. So, and because of that, that is why the medium is so important of street art. Is that the actual techniques you do to quickly make art is very complicated.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why tagging is so prevalent is because if you can make a very simple character or iconography or just, like, name, like, lettering, then you can do that very quickly when nobody's looking.
Yeah.
And so that's why, so this is part of why spray paint is such a huge part of tagging, because spray paint is easy to apply very quickly, roughly. Spray paint cans can go in a backpack, obviously. It's just, it's easy to travel, quick to apply, doesn't really need to dry in the same way that traditional paint does, and can be put on pretty much anything.
Yeah.
There's always a roughness associated with it because of that. That, like, because spray paint is, like, not quite accurate, it's very messy, and also because the different surfaces you put it on give it sort of different appearances, putting it on metal versus concrete versus brick, it'll all look different.
Yeah, it's a kind of art that is impermanent, but in a sort of, like, very specific, like, positive way.
Yeah.
Like, its impermanence seems to be kind of the point. Like, yes, this is almost certainly going to get painted over, at least if you do it in, like, a high enough traffic area, but the fact that you were able to make something that was big enough and was important enough to have to force, you know, a company or something to paint back over their walls is itself part of the statement.
Yeah, you're making a big company waste money by cleaning it up. But also, you often see stencils, which are, you know, cut out so that you can spray paint through the stencil. That makes it easier to apply more fine details.
Yeah.
This is why there's often monochrome graffiti in street art, is that you have the stencil so that it covers up one color and then another color. And then also, you often have stickers and similar things like that, where you're essentially just applying adhesive.
Yeah.
Because that way you can get as fine detailed as you want beforehand, and then, you know, insert it whenever, wherever, as long as it sticks.
I just want to make a brief moment. I've looked over to our lawyer, and I just kind of, I guess, just insert the Jet Set Radio disclaimer here of street art is art, but also illegal. We, for legal purposes, are not condoning you to go out and tag a place.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about it, and we're going to be talking about it positively, but just to cover our ass legally, we are not saying you should go do this.
Yes.
Nor are we admitting that we have done this ourselves.
Correct.
Anyway, so yeah, street art leads us to the specific topic, which is Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Yes.
So, Exit Through the Gift Shop is a documentary directed by Banksy, who is a big name that we're going to be getting into later, that it is mostly about street art. It is about, like, the culture of street art, the rise of street art. It is centered around generally one specific guy, Terry Guetta, who you may also know as Mr. Brainwash, or may not. That is sort of, that ends up being his street art name, more or less.
His tag.
And the sort of by-text story is that, Terry was a guy who filmed everything because of personal reasons. He ended up, like, kind of obsessed with just filming absolutely everything. And serendipitously, his cousin, I think it was his cousin, is actually Invader, who is his own quite famous street artist, who specifically would like create enamel stencils, like enamel glue things that you put up.
Mosaics.
Enamel mosaics of Space Invader.
And other aliens. Like arcade sprites, like yeah. Pac-Man ghosts.
And would like glue them to different places, which brings us to fun fact number one. We actually know where an Invader spot was because the ghostly silhouette of it, the worn like X placement of it, it was actually on a brick wall really close to our high school.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
We're kind of a big deal.
We're kind of we've seen Space Invader from the people who saw Space Invader. Yeah. I love the concept of Space Invader because while it is sort of a tag in that he has like a concept, it is also a statement that like for one thing it's invading spaces. With Space Invaders, very clever pun there, but also that this is something very childish and like fun going into these drab, boring building spaces. Oftentimes they'd be hidden under like an overpass or on like a alley wall. And so it also feels like they're kind of just out of reach.
Yeah.
Like just lurking behind the sort of bland surface is fun in game time.
Yep.
So Terry, he goes around France with Invader for a while, just sort of filming him and his other street art buddies. He meets a number of other street artists there, and eventually he is able to get in touch with Shepard Fairey, who is a street artist.
Yep. Also, I believe that, Terry is French, but I believe at this point he had actually moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah, Terry was a like small business owner in L.A.
Yeah.
Whereas Invader, I believe, was French, living in France at the time.
Yeah.
So Shepard Fairey, otherwise known as Obey, is a street artist that was known for putting up this sort of poster stencil of Andre the Giant with the words Obey under it. And later on, he would be picked up to make the famous Hope campaign poster for Obama's presidential campaign in 2008.
Yep. Yeah, if you have seen that Hope, that Hope image, then you have seen Shepard Fairey's work.
I really want to bring up, by the way, that the intro of the documentary plays the song The Streets Are Ours, or something like that.
Yes!
And that is the most thesis statement, you know, as it sort of drives by and shows a pretty big mix of street art styles. And also, I think it does show some skateboarding during that intro as well, is pretty funny.
It specifically does, and I made note of that it's very nice that it shows a skateboard to tie it to our enjoyment of skateboard culture.
Yeah. Also, so during the start of the documentary, as it's going through some of Terry's early footage before he met, before he started filming Invader, there's a surprise Jay Leno video, which yeah. I think is really funny in 2022,
yeah.
Having watched the three or so episodes of the Gray Leno show.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, Jay Leno.
Yep. So, Terry gets involved with Shepard Fairey, Terry and Fairey. He starts filming Shepard Fairey a lot under the pretense of making a documentary. And through that, he learns a lot about the world of street art, the practices, the people, the locations and whatnot. And he gets to learning. He meets a lot of street artists. And around the time of that is when Banksy started to come up.
So, Banksy.
There's a lot to talk about with Banksy.
There sure is.
So, Banksy is a street artist, presumably from London, because that's kind of where he started and did a lot of his work early on. He is maybe the most famous street artist in the world.
Infamous, maybe?
Both?
Both.
He's done a lot of very controversial works, but he's also... He is the high art artist. So he makes his style of street art. He doesn't do a ton of tagging nowadays. He, for a long time, would go for more... environmental street art, I would say, where it's not just a picture, it is a picture that plays off the surroundings in a way that creates a sort of realism to it.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of them with, like, rats hanging out near sewer drains. One of my favorites is, there's, like, a wall where the like, not wallpaper, but sort of the covering of the wall on the outside is peeling off. And so he painted like a maid vacuuming the wall. And so the vacuum sucks up the corner of the wall there. And he also eventually would start doing more like sculpture work. There's a pretty famous one of a phone booth being pickaxed, murdered to death.
Yep, that's one that we get to see in the documentary.
Mm-hmm. He also has done like a 3D like sculpture of a girl floating away on a balloon that I think caused a bit of a stir. He also has done some really wild things, like painting street art on the Western Wall.
Yeah, so the West Bank Wall.
Yeah, the West Bank Wall dividing Palestine and Israel.
Yep. So that is sort of the turning point in the documentary. So I do want to bring up a couple things about the medium of the documentary itself.
Yeah.
Specifically two things. One, this is a documentary that is directed by Banksy. And so I just think it's important to keep that in mind, because that specific incident is when the documentary frames it as this is what broke street art into the mainstream.
Yeah.
Now, I don't specifically have a reason to doubt that. However, I do just want to say that, like, you know, it is directed by Banksy. It could be very Banksy-centric. And so that could be not entirely accurate.
Right.
It's important to remember that your documentaries kind of have a bit of a something. Your documentaries that you watch have, like, a narrative to them.
Yeah.
And so, like, actual history could be a little more shaky.
The camera has a bias.
Yes.
The most documentarians want to present a story, and they want to present it accurately, but there's obviously conflicts between those. I don't really think Banksy would be the type of person to make himself so front and centered in that instance.
Yes.
But like I said, or like you said, don't really have anything to go against that claim.
Yeah.
The second
little thing, though, I do want to just say is that there's a scene that shows some spray paint that says Banksy is a fucking sellout.
Yeah.
And the fact that that is in the documentary is kind of hilarious to me.
Yeah. It's very self-aware in a way. I think that, like, by that point, street art had definitely been a style that artists had used in other things, like graphic design and entertainment. But I think the actual medium of street art itself hadn't been as big.
Yeah.
There was sort of the aesthetic of street art without the actual street, just the art. I also love, so I have this book called Banksy, Wall in Peace, written by Banksy. I'm borrowing it from my uncle. And it's a art book of different pieces Banksy has made with commentary by him. And I love the story of him painting one of the walls in on the West Bank Wall, and somebody saying, like, you made our wall very pretty, and he says, thank you. And then the person says, we don't want it pretty, we want it demolished, fuck off.
That's hilarious, and I love that.
Yeah.
So I love that, because I think that shows the level of self-awareness. Banksy is a complicated character, quote-unquote.
Yeah.
And, like, again, especially from, like, a 2022 internet leftist area, it's a case of, like, on one hand, he's definitely very rich. On the other hand, from what I can tell, he donates a lot of the money from the pieces that are sold of his.
Yeah, so it's important to note a few things with Banksy. One is that because he's so prominent, he's one of the street artists that actually does get shown at, like, art auctions. For a while, people would literally demolish walls that had Banksy pieces on them and then resell the wall as a sort of makeshift canvas. And those, I don't think he really saw any money from.
Yes.
Especially, I love the Banksy piece that had a rigged shredder in the frame.
Yeah.
So that when it would be sold, somebody in the audience had, like, a switch to turn on the shredder and shred the painting. Because he does not like the high art world.
Yeah. For good reason.
He has done art installations and art exhibits. There's one that features pretty heavily in the movie. As well as there's a, I don't want to say recent, because I think it was like 2016, but there is Dismayland, which was sort of a art theme park that Banksy directed.
Oh yeah, Dismayland.
Yeah. So he's definitely done, like, projects like that, and that has assumedly given him enough money to keep doing this as a job. But he doesn't often do, like, contract work. The only time I can think of was The Simpsons, where they asked him to make a couch gag, and he made one that was incredibly scathing of Fox. of like, it literally cuts to like a sweatshop of animators animating a Simpsons cell. This was the same time they had Don Hertzfeldt do a couch gag, and we all know how that went.
Oh boy.
Two best couch gags, right, one after another. Get fucked, John Crickfalusi. So yeah, Banksy is prominent. He has morals, I guess. He has a philosophy that I think comes through in a lot of his work and his actions. I'll put it like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think the highest compliment I can give Banksy as a person is that I think he is assumedly a white guy who recognizes that one white guy saying fuck the establishment and getting paid to do it is not going to like solve everything. And like that level of self-reflection, especially in like, you know, people who are leftists who get big on being leftists and then kind of become shitheads afterwards or even before, like that level of reflection is a lot to actually have.
Right. It's also worth noting that like nobody knows who Banksy really is,
which is a fucking feat in the year of our Lord 2022.
Yeah, he has a tight group of confidants and he doesn't let anybody else know. Presumably Terry is one of such confidants.
Yeah.
Because Terry has met him in person and seen his face. One thing I love is that in the documentary, it does like the candid interview shots with Banksy narrating and like seeing him in person. He obviously is talking through a voice modulator of some sort to make his voice less recognizable. But also, he's wearing a hood and his face is blacked out. But there is this framed, jarred, like, monkey mask, which he has used previously while doing street art. And so every time I watch it, I'm focusing on the monkey mask because it's lit up. It's like, it's meant to draw your attention to the monkey mask instead of Banksy.
Yeah.
Which is a genius shot. He doesn't have to wear the mask and he has the mask on.
Yeah.
So yeah, Banksy's big. He travels to the U.S. and, he asks around for, like, a helper in the U.S. and Shepard Fairey's like, I know a guy who knows where all the best spots are. And he introduces Banksy to Terry.
Yep.
This was a I know a guy situation. Terry was the guy.
Terry was the guy who Shepard Fairey knew.
He was the guy who he knew, yeah. And so through this contact, he follows Banksy around, helps him around in L.A., and it leads to one of the other, like, main climaxes of the movie, which is the Disneyland heist.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Here's I respect Banksy because he's not a fucking coward.
Yes. Like, it would be super easy to not do a single fucking thing anymore as Banksy, but he goes out to Disneyland. This is during Gitmo. Like, Gitmo is still in the public consciousness. I think this was 2009.
Or so.
And he inflates up this, you know, big, like, inflatable thing that looks like a prisoner at Gitmo. Hangs it on, like, the fence near one of the rides. Specifically on one of those cameras that would, like, take your picture.
Yeah, near Thunder Mountain.
Yeah. And then, like, they have to shut down the ride. And then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Banksy is able to change of clothes and get out of the park in disguise. Whereas Terry is, like, captured by guards and brought into questioning.
Yeah.
And he like, deletes all evidence from his camera, so he eventually gets let go without anything. But he's probably banned from the parks.
Yeah.
Which is just, like, wild that they didn't get arrested or anything.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that whole thing is recounted in the documentary.
Yeah, with footage. I don't know how he still managed to keep some of the footage, but...
Yeah. Maybe he didn't really delete it. We'll get to that in a bit. I just want to finish the plot summary, quote unquote.
Yes, absolutely.
So after this, Banksy's like, man, you have all this footage and you haven't actually made a documentary. You should put together this footage. And so Terry does. And he makes Life Remote Control, a short film that is like, here's the thing. Life Remote Control is framed as being shit in the movie.
Yeah.
I think it's ahead of its time. It is an experimental art piece where, like, it is, like, changing the channel, and every channel is footage Terry has recorded from his life. Some of it is street art, some of it isn't. It has very jarring cuts. It's very loud and very noisy. But, like, that's still art, you know? Like, I feel like nowadays that would be welcomed on the internet.
Yeah, it would be welcomed on the internet, and it could very easily, like, pass as sort of, like, a critique of the internet culture and, like, the constant everything of the internet.
Yes.
The a little bit of everything all of the time of the internet.
Yes, it's very Bradburyan.
Yeah.
But Banksy's like, this is kind of shit, but he doesn't say that because nobody wants to tell Terry no.
Yeah.
So Banksy instead is like, here, how about you make some street art, you know? You've done it, you've seen so many people do it, you can do it too. So he makes a, like, sticker logo of him holding a camera. It's really cool. That would have been great if that's all he did. But eventually, he decided he wanted to do an art show. This was after he went to one of Banksy's art shows that we mentioned earlier.
I do want to specifically mention one little interesting thing, which is that a lot of the places he tags with his, like, his Terry sticker, his Terry's, like, logo, are actually, like, either very near or literally are places that Shepard Fairey has tagged.
Yeah, that's funny.
Or that, like, other places that he has filmed tagging.
Yeah. So, Terry starts making art, and then he's like, this is hard. And so he hires a bunch of artists to make the art for him. He becomes an ideas guy, where he says what art he wants to be made, and then the other artists he pays make the art for him.
Okay. You're not wrong. I'm going to step up to the bat briefly.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so this is a correct explanation. However, I'm going to put this in a bit of context. So, what Terry does is Terry has the idea for art, and then he has graphic designers that are, I believe, on payroll. I would assume on payroll.
I would hope so.
Yeah. And so he says, hey, I have this idea. It's like a piece of, you know, art that's like Marilyn Manson, but like highly pop art. And the graphic designer goes, okay, and makes that art, which, you know, graphic designers do a lot of good work.
I really want to correct you on that, but I don't know if you actually mean Marilyn Manson or not.
I said Marilyn Manson, and I didn't mean it, but I decided to stick with it.
Okay.
And so, so he gets this picture, and like that is the thing. Like, it's like, you know, one of the signature styles that he comes up with is like pictures that are lined into barcodes. Where it's like, you know, a picture of Louis Armstrong or something that, like, you know, is made into a barcode that's like, you know, the spaces in between. Well, the spaces in between aren't exactly negatives. It's genuinely, like, really cool looking art.
Right.
I think the problem comes in where Terry does not frame it when he then talks about the ideas as, like, you know, I had people make this because I had this idea of. He frames it as, like, he's literally pointing at the piece and going, I made this because it's, like, you know, Brainwash.
Right. So he comes up with the name Mr. Brainwash while he's doing his actual, like, solo work. His idea is, like, graffiti is like Brainwash. I will become Mr. Brainwash.
We can make fun of his accent. He's French. I'm just
doing an impression. It's not meant to be a negative. That's just his voice.
It's French. It's meant to be a negative.
So, okay. So, he, like, through this process in his whole crew, he has a gallery in, like, an abandoned TV show studio. And it's multi-story, has a ton of rooms, has just a lot of stuff in many different styles. And he's worried about it until he asks around because he's not sure he'll actually recover from this. He breaks his leg during setup. He's going through a lot of stress. He only realizes the severity and size and scope of what he's doing once he breaks his leg and has a sobering moment. But he asks for some help from his street art friends, including a quote from Banksy, which is something like, what is it? Like,
it's something like Mr. Brainwash is... It's literally like Mr. Brainwash is the craziest motherfucker I've ever seen. That is not a compliment.
Yeah, it's throughout the entire movie, Banksy constantly like does this very backhanded thing to Terry. Like every sentence he says about Terry, you can tell it's steeped in sort of dislike.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to hurt his feelings, or at least he wants to seem neutral. But so, yeah, he gives this quote, Terry puts it on the billboard, suddenly everyone wants to know who Mr. Brainwash is, because Banksy gave a quote.
Yeah.
He got the Banksy. And so, come opening day, all of LA is lining up to go in there. They have, like, Brad Pitt is there. There's, like, other celebrities.
I think Brad Pitt was there at the Banksy one. I don't know if celebrities were showing up to his, but... I think there were some celebrities, but the bigger thing is that a bunch of people show up and end up buying his art. He ends up, like, getting offers for pieces, like, before they've even really opened.
Yeah, he sells prints that have all been customized in that he just kind of splattered paint on them, not even in, like, an interesting Pollock way. Just like going by in a desk chair and flicking paint at them. We'll get to the criticism later.
We'll get to our criticism later.
So he sells a ton of, you know, one of a kind unique prints, sells a ton of other artwork in there. There's bits of like the general public talking about the art. I love there's these two guys that I assume are married, and one of them's like, it's very interesting, and you can tell he's trying not to say that it's garbage to the camera. But yeah, like all these random people are like, you know, it's very insightful. It says a lot of things about society, and it's a very fun time.
Yeah.
And then it all ends with, well, essentially
the ending is kind of like a big everybody is talking about Mr. Brainwash, and like everybody, Shepard Fairey, Banksy, like the random people who helped him, everybody is kind of like, you know, he's Mr. Brainwash.
Yeah.
I think there's a specific quote from Banksy that's like, I used to say that, you know, I used to encourage anybody to do art. I used to say that, you know, like, everybody should go out and do art. And, you know, I don't really say that as much anymore.
Yeah. And it ends with a shot of, Terry spray painting the last wall of that, that TV studio as it's being demolished with, I want to say, like, life is art or life is good or something
in French. The name of the exhibit was, like,
Life is beautiful?
That's it. Life is beautiful.
Life is beautiful.
Yeah. And,
And then it does, like, a Where Are They Now, which is really funny when it's an old.
Yeah.
They are no longer there now.
It's a 2010 movie.
The
so
now
like,
is a was.
Where Are They Was? Mm-hmm. There's also two more quotes from Banksy about Terry, which is, one, there's nobody quite like Terry, even if his art looks a lot like everyone else's.
Yeah.
And, oh god, what's the second one? There's another, like, exceptional quote.
God.
Warhol, repeated art until it was meaningless, and Terry, repeated it until it was truly meaningless.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's start off this actual, like, commentary portion by saying, who is Terry?
Yeah.
Here's the big thing. It tricks you into thinking it's a documentary about street art when really it's about Terry. It is about street art, but it's really about Terry in the context of street art and street art in the context of Terry. He is an immigrant, he is a business owner, family man, loves filming, he attributes that to some traumatic events in his childhood. He just kind of obsessively films everything. He was lucky and he knew the right people to get to where he was. Connections are everything.
Yep.
Never forgetty. And I think what's so interesting is, so his art, for one thing, I'm going to put on my art glasses and then I'm going to take them off because I'm going to sound like a ding dong. And I'm sure like my brother's going to have something to say about my analysis here because he knows art, but Terry's art in the Mr. Brainwash exhibit in Life is Beautiful is very, very, very derivative in a pretty rough way. Like, he kind of just repeats things Andy Warhol did. Like, there's a reason why Banksy brings up Warhol, because the centerpiece of the exhibit is a spray paint can, like a giant spray paint can, which is also, I don't remember the name of the sculptor, the guy that does everyday objects in big mode, but it's made to look like a Campbell's soup can. And Campbell's soup was the Warhol icon.
Yeah.
Where Warhol was about turning pop culture objects back into art, And like Banksy says, repeating it till it was meaningless, till it no longer is just a brand or a product. It is just a picture. There's also a ton of sort of revisions on the Marilyn Monroe iconography that Warhol did. A lot of the four-panel sort of like repetition.
Yeah, he makes a lot of four comas, which is weird.
Yeah, but you know, with like different colors in each one. Yeah. Very Demon Days. Is that what Demon Days album covers? Anyways, and so it's like, it's hard for me to look at a lot of the stuff in his gallery and just feel like he's copying Warhol.
He's copying Warhol. He's also definitely copying Banksy and Fairy.
Well, yeah, he has a ton of stuff in Fairy's style of like chiaroscuro, sort of high contrast shadows. In the Banksy stuff as well, of course. I also want to mention that the barcode stuff is probably my favorite art of his that he does in that portion.
Yes.
It's very Lichtenstein, and I think there was another similar artist who, instead of doing pointillism, did, like, lineism. It's very similar to these other artists, essentially.
Yeah.
People who weren't quite contemporary at that point, but also he kind of did his contemporaries as well. It's not to say that art has to be original, because all good art is on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, this is sort of part of where I get a little bit complex feelings, where, like, on one hand, a lot of Terry's art in this film, like, it is very derivative, it is has obvious influences, and even more obvious influences once you've seen the entire film. On the other hand, there's just, like, there are nuggets of actual kind of gold there.
Yeah.
Like, there are, he is an ideas guy, and we can kind of sit here and, like, kind of make fun of him, because the film itself kind of makes fun of him for it. But, like, there are genuinely nuggets of, like, actually really interesting ideas there.
Right. Yeah. I like the barcode stuff because I feel like it has the most substance. Oh, I forgot. He did copy Banksy's style of classical paintings with modern things added in posthumously.
Yes.
Not as well, either, I would say.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, a lot of times it does feel like he's kind of just doing what he's seen, not just in terms of the content or the medium, but the theme, like the sort of message he's presenting. Like, Elvis with a toy gun from Fisher-Price.
Yeah.
Like, that's clever and all, but it feels very trodden already.
Yeah, it feels like we have seen this style multiple times, even in 2010.
It's like, I don't know if he's actually putting any of himself in the artwork. I wouldn't be surprised if he did, but, like, he's viewing things from a different sort of, like, he feels very impressionable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I
think part of why everybody doesn't want to treat him poorly is he's kind of acts childish. Not like a child as, like, spoiled or anything. But he has this air of, like, curiosity and, like, means welling.
Yeah. Terry as a person seems like a good person. And, like, I would even go so far as to this day having kind of skimmed through some of his website and stuff, seems like kind of a cool dude.
Except the NFTs.
We're getting to those in just a moment, don't yeah. worry. But like, he's done art with the Pope like 3 times apparently. One of the most recent in 2021. I don't know why, but like,
hey kids, it's time for art with the Pope. Today we're gonna be painting the crucifixion. Yay.
The Pope is just like, I'm making this funny skeleton from this game that this one guy gave me. I believe his name was Sand.
Sand Undertale.
Do you think we could get the Pope on this podcast? I mean, he's talked to Matt Pat and Taryn fucking Mr. Brainwash.
Oh my god, I would love to interview the Pope.
Yes.
But only in the context of, like, talking about something funny.
Oh.
Like Killer Bean Forever.
Yeah. Hey, actually, you know what? I want a call to action. I made the joke earlier. I made a joke about a call to action earlier. I want a genuine call to action. Just pause for 1 second. So, okay. I think that this might be projecting. I think every, like, small, tiny podcast has that, like, little nugget of, like, ooh, but, like, what if we could score one big one? Here is what I want. Banksy, if you are listening, you probably aren't, you might be, if you are listening, I don't want to interview you about your work. I do not want you to, like, come to St. Louis and do street art with us, as cool as that would be. Like, I don't want any of that. However, I would love to do an episode over Mark Echo's Getting Up, the PlayStation 2 game. And if there was any way I was going to do that episode, if there was anything to convince me to actually do that, it would be to get Banksy as the guest speaker. So here's my promise to you, our fans. Don't talk to Banksy. Don't bother Banksy. But, like, if we can get Banksy, we will do an episode over Mark Echo's Getting Up for the PlayStation 2.
You don't even have to do it in person.
Yeah, we could do it over Discord or whatever.
Imagine being Discord friends with Banksy. Immediately deletes his account after recording.
Oh. You don't even need to make an account. You can just go.
Okay. If not Mark Echo's Getting Up, I will also offer Disney's Epic Mickey.
Ooh, yeah. That would actually be a really good episode, too.
Or I had another good one, De Blob for the Wii.
If you want to talk about one of those three things, or all three of those, hey, welcome to Banksy Month. This week, we're talking about De Blob with Banksy.
Now, Banksy, you yourself are a bit of a blob.
So, yes, okay. That's the only call to action. That's the only time I'm going to directly ask a person we're talking about to contact us.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I would expect Shepard Fairey maybe to listen to this, but not Banksy.
That's fine. I don't know that I want Shepard Fairey on the podcast.
Yeah, so we'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, his demeanor, Terry's demeanor seems well, but his ideas seem a little, like, not as inspired. And again, you don't have to be completely original, but it doesn't feel as much like he's putting a lot of himself in it. It feels very inauthentic.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of NFTs, I do love that the unique, quote-unquote, prints are essentially just NFTs, but, you know, as prints.
Yeah.
Not just the sense that it's art that somebody made, but that they're, like, mass-produced, and he just barely made them unique.
Okay, I'm going to come up to bat for Terry for this one. So he makes a bunch of prints and then, like, literally just kind of splashes art occasionally, like, splashes spray paints. He just splashes some paint. He
now
spray
we just
paints.
Add a splash of art.
Yes. And just a splash of art.
Brilliant.
And, like, it's definitely, like, it is very much, like, not really putting a lot of himself. It is kind of the easiest way to just make a bunch of unique prints. I do kind of love that. I kind of love it. Like, obviously, it was done out of necessity,
yeah.
But, like, it's kind of, like, functionally, what is the difference between that and just, like, signing your name to a bunch of different
posters? That's fair.
That's the only, like, that is how much I'm going to go up to bat for this.
So, it's not so much what he does to make them individual, it's the fact that he decided first to sell a bunch of prints, and then he had to figure a way to do that.
Yeah.
And he also just kind of mass-produced prints.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like signing your own, signing, like, I mean, I don't know. I guess it's not different from signing, like, a book you wrote, but also knowing the rest of how it was made, it still feels iffy.
It feels very much like, it doesn't feel like I want to put a little bit of myself into this art, even as much as, like, a signature is kind of putting a bit of yourself into a poster, for example,
it's,
you know?
It's the line in Hardware Store. I keep thinking about this. They're doing a promotional stunt. There's a great big purple sign out front that says every 27th customer will get a bullpen hammer free. It's that.
Yeah.
It's a promotional stunt. And it's a big white sign with Banksy's quote on it. So, yeah, it's very complicated. It's also very fitting that on my other monitor, there's currently a video in the recommended videos about Kojima in Death Stranding, because I wanted to talk about auteur theory.
Yes.
This is a very complicated topic for me, because it's something I've kind of gone around a ton. So, auteur theory is specifically that there is a author for works who has a huge impact on the work itself, in that much of the quality of a work can be translated back to the author. It is a lens of looking at large productions in terms of a managerial structure back to the director.
Yes.
You see this with movies a lot. You know, you have a David Lynch movie, you have a Stanley Kubrick movie. These are not movies made with David Lynch and his, you know, filming and lighting and casting and costume and rigging and sound and editing crew. And I think these tend to take away a lot of the credit that those people get. Like, I love learning about, like, costume designers that worked on all of these famous movies, because I'm like, I had no idea they existed, but their work is so prevalent.
Yeah. Famously, the Lord of the Rings movies had to have a literal army's worth of chainmail, and so, you know, just, like, four or five costume designers just literally linked together chains for months.
Yeah.
Just clock in, link chains, clock out. That was their sole job, and that's amazing.
Now, what you also end up with is that the flip side is that there is an undeniable aspect to these works based on the author. So, like, when you watch a, you know, Quentin Tarantino movie, it is pretty undoubtedly Quentin Tarantino. If you watch a Wes Anderson movie, you see all these traits of Wes Anderson, and you're like, this is a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
So to some extent, it is hard to deny that that the director has a huge impact on the work. You see this sometimes in indie games, as far as video games go, like Jonathan Blow in particular. But also you see this with AA games like Hidetaka Miyazaki in From Software. He had a huge impact on the company post-Demon Souls, but also there's people working under him and with him. Yeah. You know, like Dark Souls 2 wasn't even Miyazaki, and while that is sort of a complex topic for Dark Souls fans, it's still undeniable that those people learned how to make parts of Dark Souls from Miyazaki.
Yeah. Auteur theory is a lens, and I don't think it should be, like, I don't think the baby should be thrown out with the bathwater, because in general, like, if I were to say there's, like, one part of this documentary that has, quote-unquote, aged poorly, well, one, there is an R slur, so
yeah.
Be aware of that. Number two, like, they don't really analyze the fact that, like, they, you know, kind of bring up the fact that obviously it's not his art exactly, but they don't really challenge that as mm-hmm. much of, like, you know, the fact that he's really just kind of got a team of graphic designers. And so, like, it is never worthwhile to say, like, ah, yes, this author is the one thing that makes it good.
Yeah.
But auteur theory, I think, is a valuable lens in that, like, you've previously brought up, like, a Kojima game is definitely a Kojima game. Like,
yeah.
You cannot look at Death Stranding or, you know, the Metal Gear Solid series without specifically looking at Kojima. And, like, that does not take away from any of the people, any of the other programmers, any of the other artists, anyone else that has specifically, you know, contributed to these products. But it is a useful lens to still consider of, like, let us think about this as one person's vision who is directing everyone else's art.
Right. And it's not to say that those people under them don't have input, which is sort of my, I don't know, my, like, wrench that gets thrown in.
Yeah.
My clashing point. There's a word for it. But that, like, the people underneath the director will still have input most of the time.
Yeah. It's the contention.
Yeah. Now, with Terry, he does sort of take the director role in that he is managing these artists, giving them the, you know, the vision, and they put it together doing the physical labor, but he does the creative work. But it is very hard to tell how much work he does in that regard. Like, they kind of just have him saying, like, I give them the ideas and then they make the art. They don't really show much of the process. If anything, they mostly show the process from the producer or the artist side, the like graphic designers and the painters and stuff.
Yeah.
And less Terry's own process.
Yeah.
And that is especially more visible when he breaks his leg and is, like, not able to put an active role into putting things together. However, it's not like Terry can't do that. Because they do show him putting up, you know, stencils and stickers in the city. So he can produce these on his own. It's hard to tell how much of it is the scale getting away from him, and thus he needs other hands, versus him wanting to take a directorial role and not a laborious role. And I think that might be a matter of framing in the documentary. I think the documentary wants to frame Terry as a bit of a tragic fool. And I don't mean that too much of an insult, but, like, it is that he aims really high and has trouble getting there. And everything that happens between Banksy telling him to make art and the exhibit opening is sort of an arc of Terry realizing his own limits, while also slowly, like, I don't know, showing how he develops in that point. It seems like he develops kind of an ego about the art, but also it's hard to say. Again, it's like, it feels like the artists working for him have more input than Terry's really giving off.
Yeah.
And that is my point with contention of him.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Shepard Fairey.
Okay.
So, another reason why I think Terry's really interesting in terms of how impressionable he is Shepard Fairey specifically, one of the artists he had worked the most with before Banksy. And this is because Shepard Fairey, I've really come to dislike him, both in terms of his presence in this, but also his, you know, current ongoing presence. He very much feels like a brand-first artist. So when he talks about Obey, he doesn't talk about it in terms of the meaning or the message. He essentially says it's like advertising. He's like, you know, somebody will see Obey on one building and then they'll see it on another and that gets them interested. Like, what is Obey? Who is Obey? And clearly that worked enough to get him a job.
Yeah, it...
And I cannot blame people for making money off art. That is, I think, the goal of a lot of artists is to make money to live while having their art unsullied by others. The ability to make personalized art while also live.
Every copy of Obey is personalized.
Yeah.
Yeah, I... The contention here for me, the sort of, like, bit of problems that I internally feel is that I... So... Within the context of the documentary, he describes the process of, like, creating Obey as essentially, like, he had this idea, he had this sticker, and he just sort of put it everywhere. And he specifically did that as, like, I put it everywhere because one sticker on its own is meaningless. But if it's everywhere, then people start asking, oh, well, you know, what's this thing? Like, this is near now a thing. And I think that is... I think from an artistic standpoint, that has merit. That idea of, like, you know, creating something that is only self, like, that is only important because of itself.
It's post this cat.
It's post this cat. It's a meme.
It's self-propagating like a parasite.
Yeah.
A memeocyte.
And, like, that idea then becoming his brand, I can't blame him for. But then, like, the next step of that is how you use that brand. Mm-hmm. The next step of that is, okay, you've imbued it with this meaning, but now you need to give that meaning something. Now you can't just be like, and now you can buy an Obey t-shirt or an Obey NFT that existed.
Yeah, he has minted NFTs.
Yeah, he has minted specifically Obey NFTs, which I find... incredibly fucking ironic.
Yeah.
Terry has also done it. From what I have read, I will specifically say that I think Terry, I'm willing to assume was just kind of like some guy who got contacted by a publicist who was like, the hip new thing is NFTs, and it's like, oh, okay, I do not know better. Shepard Fairey, I expect to know better than to mint fucking NFTs.
Yeah. Shepard Fairey feels like, it's very cynical take on his work, I guess, but, like, he feels like somebody who is actually sold out. Like, somebody who is using his notoriety from street art to become a high artist where his goal is to make money off of rich people. Which, sure, eat the rich, but, like, also, if you're gonna do NFTs like that, it's hard to say that's eating the rich.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing about this, though. Is that the legality of street art makes it really difficult to avoid this fate. That in order for street art to be legal, you have to be well-liked by the establishment who owns the buildings and the property. And Shepard Fairey has done that, but in turn, this has made it that he is now a sort of arm of the establishment. He is catering to the elite because that makes his artwork legal.
Yeah.
Whereas Banksy is still technically, you know, illegal. He is still riding that edge of, like, you know, this is only allowed because people know it's a Banksy and so they leave it on the wall. But by all intents and purposes, this is, you know, vandalism.
Yeah.
For the law's concern. And the fact that Banksy is still anonymous means that he does not want to sell his artwork to the establishment because he doesn't care about his art becoming legal. He doesn't need that recognition from that sort of high art world.
Yeah.
Whereas Shepard Fairey, it's hard to view it as anything other than, like, he is now a rich artist instead of a poor artist.
Yeah.
It's another thing. Every underground movement has this, though, that, like, it eventually becomes mainstream and normalized. Like, skateboarding became popularized and normalized when Tony Hawk did the 900, and then he put his name on everything, and now including Metaverse.
Yeah, I'm very sad about Tony Hawk.
Tony Hawk.
I was willing to give the benefit of the doubt for the NFT collection. I was like, okay, a bunch of people got suckered into this. But now he's getting really into the, like, Metaverse stuff, and it's like, no, Tony, please.
Tony, please.
Please, Tony.
Please, Tony.
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 Petscop Tony.
No, Petscop Tony has not done any of that, luckily.
Oh, yeah, no. Petscop Tony is the good Tony.
Yeah. But, yeah, so like, it's hard to view this as a fault of Shepard Fairey himself. Another one is, like, punk music.
Yeah.
You know, you start off with something that's edgy in counterculture, and then it becomes something like Good Charlotte, who are on Australia's Got Talent or whatever.
Yeah. And it's just, like, it's, like, you can't exactly...
Specifically for eating KFC. I want to bring that up.
Wait, Good Charlotte got on Australia's Got Talent for eating KFC?
Yeah.
Wait, they got on Australia's Got Talent for eating KFC?
I'm pretty sure. This could be a old wives' tale, or old husband's tale, or old partner's tale. But I don't know, that's what I've heard. Good Charlotte ate KFC on Australian television.
All right, and next up on American Idol, Jackson Pollock!
It's money, is that the problem?
So, yeah, it's this is just sort of the problem with counterculture becoming culture, and it's a constant issue. I mean, you know, wokeness is, you know, the kind of the newest example where it's like, you know, fucking Raytheon is like, haha, we support our members of the LGBT community and their ability to make big weapons to blow up people from across a different nation. Like, it's a problem, and it's an ongoing problem, and it's not unique to street art, but in the specific ways of, like, within the specific lens of this documentary, it is sort of, like, the unenviable question to ask is, like, is Banksy a sellout? You know, like,
it feels oftentimes that Banksy's career for the last 10 to 15 years has been him constantly fighting pressure from the high art world to he wants to remain a regular, like, street artist in One of the People, whereas high art is constantly trying to make him out to be this next messiah.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's just. High art is bullshit, by the way.
Yeah.
Just in general, high art is bullshit. It is money laundering. It is almost entirely randomness, more or less.
Flexing.
Yeah.
People flexing wealth.
It's
there is this art collector in the documentary who's like, oh, I just have a couple Van Goghs in my attic.
Yeah.
We go to her attic, and she has all these random paintings that aren't even hanging. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And then what's even better is she appears again at the Mr. Brainwash Life is Beautiful show.
Yeah.
Just like, oh my God, of course.
Dear.
That's sort of the arc of the whole documentary, though.
Yeah.
It is underground becoming too mainstream for its own good. And, you know, it catalogs this sort of, I don't know, this progression of Terry from family man with sort of an obsession to big artist not knowing really what to do with himself. And then it also just covers street art becoming mainstream and then too mainstream for its own good.
Yeah.
The final scene of the movie, really, when everybody's talking about Terry, it kind of brings this question of what is art, really? Who are artists, and what is the art world?
Yeah, because, like, Terry succeeded. Terry is a success story. And, like, honestly, I don't want to throw a lot of shade onto Terry. From everything I've seen, he seems, like, more or less a cool guy, too. But, like, at the same time, it's... with this documentary as context, it's like, you cannot walk away from it going, yeah, Terry is a good artist.
Yeah, the art world is working as intended. Art is given value based on objective qualities.
Exactly.
And people know good art when they see it, and they will only pay money for good art.
Yeah, it's honestly the like obey sticker feels like it might as well be foreshadowing to, you know, the Terry art show, the Life is Beautiful art show, where it's like, you know, it became this big thing because it looked big and important, and so people assumed it was big and important.
Yeah, it had Banksy's name. It's a story of connections and marketing more than it is about Terry's struggle as an artist.
Yeah.
And I do love the quote from Banksy at the end that art is a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like, is all of them are left dumbfounded at this beast they've created.
Yeah.
They don't know what to say about Terry, because in a way, implicating Terry is implicating themselves.
Yeah, if they criticize Terry for like, but you just did a bunch of, you know, big art shows and then sold out and sold a bunch of art. It's like, well, that's what Shepard Fairey did. That's what Banksy did. That's what a lot of these artists did.
Yeah.
So, like,
they're not ready to ask themselves the question that, like, by creating on accident Mr. Brainwash, not Terry, but Mr. Brainwash specifically, they have put a hole in their own sort of facade and exposed further the facade of high art into the public.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One little thing I want to talk about with this movie. I love how analog this movie is.
Yeah.
It's an analog horror series.
Oh no. Tags corruption.
It feels the gulf between 2010 and 2020 is so massive in terms of just like, you know, in 2010, a lot of smartphones were around, but not, like, there was not ubiquitous smartphones, you know? Like, you were able to be cell phone filmed, but, like, it wasn't like anybody could just take a picture of you and throw it onto Twitter and suddenly out your entire personality. Like, there was, it feels, I as a person do not want to say street art is dead because I'm not part of the scene, I don't get to say that. But, like, to a normie like me, in terms of this, it feels like this is an entirely bygone era where it's like, you know, I can't go up to my local fucking bank and spray paint the side. There's a bunch of cameras. There's a bunch of passersby with a fucking camera in their home, or, like, in their pocket, you know? Like, you can't do a lot of these styles of things and not get caught anymore. Now, that does mean that a lot of, like, this style of punk, you know, like, art and stuff has shifted a lot more online. Look anywhere online and you will find a lot of, like, you know, leftist, anarchist, punk, communist art made by, you know, random artists on Twitter, if not, you know, like, art collectives and stuff. I mean, indie video games, for that matter. There's a lot of, like, really cool art from that. Night in the Woods is one I'm going to shout out, because everybody has to talk about it if they're a leftist. If you're a leftist and you haven't played Night in the Woods, no, you're not.
Damn, I'm not a leftist.
So, like, that is something worth keeping in mind, is, like, you know, there's no revolution anymore, but there kind of is. But at the same time, that's different. You know, it's a different vibe. It feels like we're online now because of necessity, not because that's what we want. You know, we have to have this ground in the digital space just because that's what's available to us. And, like, you know, with Web 3.0 kind of around the corner, it feels like that's going to be the new thing, where it's like, we have the VR chat, the metaverse bullshit. Shoutouts to VR chat, getting rid of mods, by the way. by which I mean anti-shoutouts. Anyway, you know, like,
is it whisper-ins?
Yeah. Anti-shoutouts. Reverse my voice in terms of a shoutout. But, like, yeah, it feels like that's going to end up being the next step, is just, like, you know, like, the issue of tiny creator-filled things versus big homogenous meta VR spaces and bullshit. And it's just, like, at a certain point, you just want to go out and like tag a wall, right? You want to just go out and be like, hey, there's an entire world here. Like, we don't have to exist on the internet. Follow us on Spotify. Like, there's an entire world outside our window.
Welcome to my forum cast. This is, of course, where me and my buddy talk in the middle of the forum and invite others to talk with us and debate us.
Unfortunately, this exists. It's called Podcast But Outside. It's made by way more famous people than us.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So that's my existential crisis.
It's a love letter to physical world.
Yeah.
To the real. I have other thoughts about VR and the metaverse and stuff like that, but that's for later.
Yeah.
I want to end this on one final sort of comment about the video, about the documentary, which is going back to Life Remote Control. This is probably the most authentic Terry art in the whole documentary.
Yes.
And I love Life Remote Control. I said it's ahead of its time. It's sort of internet-y. It reminds me of, like, Sad World, almost.
Yeah.
Oh,
man.
And it's available for purchase, apparently, on Shepherd Fairey's website. But, like, I don't know. It's so interesting to me that this is the art Terry made. Everybody kind of said it was shit, and I feel really bad for Terry because, like, no, I don't think it's that shit because it's so earnest and it's him, you know?
Yeah.
It's what he decided to do. It's what he wanted to convey. It might not be perfect. It might not be a good documentary, but it definitely feels like more art than anything in his exhibit.
Yeah. I think the last point I want to make here is that this is sort of a broader thing. I want to end this on kind of a positive aspect, and that's that the great man theory is bullshit. So we've specifically talked about kind of the big three because they are relevant to this documentary. We've talked about Banksy, Shepherd Fairey, and Mr. Brainwash. But, like, don't let the fact that, you know, two people have sold out, even if they are really big people, don't let that, like, dissuade you from making art yourself. Making legal art, of course. But, like, the big names are not the only names. This documentary itself has, of course, Invader, but it also has, like, a bunch of other, like, rapid-fire different people. Bogo, I think, was one.
Swoon.
Yes, yeah, Swoon.
That's a good name.
And so, like, they're, like, a revolution is not built on the back of one giant. It is built on the back of 100,000 different people.
Like Pikmin.
Much like Pikmin. Pikmin is the most communist game, is what we're saying. If you haven't gotten that.
Or Wonderful 101.
Ooh, Wonderful 101 is also a very good game. But the point here is just that, like, while we have sort of discussed things like, you know, the big names selling out and, like, you know, the idea that, like, one person can't save the world even if they're big, rich, and famous, like, don't let that dissuade you from just finding more people you enjoy even if only three other people know their name. Like, street art is a collaborative effort, and a big part of it is getting your name out there, is getting some prestige, even if, you know, it's just prestige within the street art, you know, community. But, like, that still is, like, that is important, and it is, like, good that it is not just a bunch of figureheads. Because, like, the modern art world genuinely is kind of just a bunch of figureheads. Like, I have that on good word from artists, too, so, like, don't get at me.
The sequel to Artists 1.
Artists 2 was so good, but I think that Miyazaki should have been there to direct it. Point being, eat the rich.
Yeah. Here's a fun game to play, by the way. Speaking of auteur theory and great man theory, play Did Hayao Miyazaki Direct This with Studio Ghibli Movies.
That sounds like a really fun game that we should play on this podcast, but on a different episode.
Yeah, now it's time for me to send this to my high school art teacher who gave me a C on my very well thought out final project.
Yeah. I wanted to, like, shout them out, like, screw you something, but I couldn't actually remember their name.
Why would we dox our high school art teacher?
We could dox a different teacher.
Did I ever tell you about the... I'll talk about it later. thanks for listening. Somehow we got this under 2 hours. I'm very impressed. Give ourselves a pats on the backs.
Yeah, we got it over.
Sorry, the give ourselves a pat on the backs.
Oh, yeah, of course. where can they find us?
You can find us on Twitter at NetSurferPro. We post teasers on upcoming episodes, info, updates on what's going on. There's been a lot of real life stuff happening for both of us, which is why we have not really been doing anything the past month or so, month and a half. But we're hoping to get back on a regular pace now that things have sort of steadied out a bit, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, we lost our groove. We've seemingly found it again, so we're hoping to keep it.
Yeah, we went through some turbulence, but now we have smooth landing.
Yep.
Yeah, other analogy. You can also find us on any podcasting platform you like, on, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, I think, is also there. Any podcasting platform you use, give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review, let us know how we're doing, let us know what topics you'd want us to cover, let us know if you are Banksy, willing to talk about one of those three games.
Yeah, please, yeah, Banksy, get at us, we want to have an entire Banksy month where we talk about nothing but games from the mid-2000s.
All Wii games, I'm pretty sure.
Getting Up is from PS2 era.
Right. I keep wanting to say Mark Echo's Getting Over It, which is a very different game. But also Getting Over It is the most street art video game. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming. I tweet about stuff I like, stuff I'm doing. I tweet when I go live on my stream at twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. And I also stream projects I'm working on, and somehow I got the... I got the honor of being Photon Punch's official publicist.
Yeah, it's a really big... He really did the give you that honor.
Yeah, the honor.
The honor. No, it's for honor, actually.
For the for honor.
He the gave you the for honor.
Yep, this is too much.
This bit is bad, and so we're going to end it much like this podcast. Yeah. You can follow me on Twitter and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWRLS0N. I post my hot takes and sometimes videos of my cat or just videos of how I'm feeling. You can also find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where I'll eventually have a video one of these days. And you can find me at Machine Gun Vampire on Twitch. I think I might actually do a stream pretty soon.
No shit.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be rating all of the music, all of the boss music's, or no, the Robot Masters music's from the NES Mega Mans.
Oh yeah. So by Robot Masters, you mean the level themes or the boss fight themes? Because it's very different.
All 8 of the boss fight themes, baby. There's 8 of them, right?
There's 6. There's 6 NES Mega Mans.
No, I wanted to do a silly little thing where I rank all of the level themes for the Robot Masters for the mainline Mega Man series. And so I think I might actually stream and do that pretty
nice.
Soon. With that has been, this has been an episode of NetSurfer Pro, that was, I believe, longer than the topic today.
Right, yeah. Now I just have to figure out how I'm gonna fix this window.
Yeah,
I wish Photon Punch would the give me some the money.
Yeah, it's really hard to get some silent windows, in this day and age.
Yeah. How do window washers go to the bathroom?
Ow.